the headlines. Iran says the new round of talks on JCPOA revival is focused on finding a mechanism for the verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions. U.S. and Russian officials preparing for security talks in January. Ukraine will be at the heart of the discussion. And Yemen says the UN is flying humanitarian supplies into Sana'a Airport temporarily, 1 week after Saudi airstrikes grounded those flights. Thanks for joining us. Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 agreement are in Vienna for a new round of talks. Tehran says the verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions and guarantees that Washington will not withdraw from the deal again will be on the agenda for the talks. The top Iranian negotiator says the two sides have agreed on the issues in principle, and talks will now focus on the mechanisms and frameworks. Omaleski reports from Vienna.
Iran's lead delegate to the Vienna talks says the eighth round of negotiations aimed at restoring the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action will be focusing on the two issues of verification and guarantees.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has announced that if an agreement is reached, the side that violated the deal, meaning the U.S., should remove the sanctions first. Iran should verify the removal of sanctions and only then take measures within the framework of the JCPOA.
Ali Bagheri-Kani says the U.S., which withdrew from the JCPOA in 2018 under the administration of Donald Trump, also needs to provide guarantees it will not withdraw again or impose sanctions in violation of the deal.
Iran's rightful and logical demand has been getting guarantees from the other side, and this, as well as the issue of verification, have in principle been accepted by them. But discussions need to take place on the mechanism, frameworks and criteria involved in order to reach a framework for an agreement.
Bagheri said the sides are set to discuss banking and financial sanctions in the coming days. Meanwhile, EU coordinator Enrique Mora says the talks need to end within a reasonable period of time, which, according to him, should be a matter of weeks rather than months. Mora said difficult political decisions need to be made, both in Tehran and Washington. Iran says if the other side shows it's ready to effectively remove sanctions and give the necessary guarantees, the talks can conclude successfully. Talks will continue at the level of experts and deputy foreign ministers in the coming days as efforts intensify to make the challenging prospect of a restored JCPOA a reality. Homolezki, Vienna.
The United States and Russia will sit down for security talks to patch up the ongoing tensions over Ukraine. A White House spokesperson says the meeting will take place on January 10. Two other separate events will also happen within days afterwards. One will see Russian and NATO officials discuss security concerns. The other will bring together Moscow, Washington, and several European countries for a broader regional meeting. Russia says the planned talks will revolve around the list of security proposals it has presented to the U.S. and NATO. Among them is a demand that the Western alliance promise to give up any military activity in Eastern Europe and in Ukraine. The West accuses Russia of preparing to invade Ukraine. Moscow says it has no such plans. U.S. President Joe Biden signs into law a defense policy bill for fiscal year 2022, which allows a rise of about 5% in military spending. The Senate and the House of Representatives voted overwhelmingly in favor of the National Defense Authorization Act earlier this month. The bill allocates $770 billion to military spending. This includes around $7 billion for what the U.S. calls the Pacific Deterrence Initiative. The plan is mainly aimed at supporting Taiwan, which China regards as part of its territory. The budget also envisages $300 million in military aid for Ukraine, which has been a source of tension between Washington and Moscow. We reached out to author and journalist Eric Wahlberg for comments. He believes the U.S. military spending has little to do with defense.
The military industry, military industrial complex in the States, it really controls the economy. This idea that America's trying to defend Taiwan or Ukraine. These are just pretexts for the profits of the military-industrial complex. The U.S. isn't like Russia or Iran, countries that have experienced horrible invasions more than once. No one's invaded the U.S. It's got no enemies. And yet it outspends all of the other countries of the world. It's completely ludicrous. The consequences are the continual erosion of America's health as a viable economy. Instead of producing food and goods for the people, it produces money and it produces arms to kill other people. So it just keeps pushing America to the brink. It's a completely insane situation, and just adding more money as a fuel to this bottomless pit.
The International Salvation Government says the United Nations humanitarian flights into the Sana'a airport are back in operation. The aviation authority in Sana'a says UN and other international humanitarian organizations are resuming their flights on a temporary basis. Multiple airstrikes by Saudi-led coalition ground flights into and out of Sana'a airport last week. Apart from massive aerial bombardments over the past 7 years, the Saudi-led coalition has been blockading Yemen from the sea, land, and from air. That has disrupted the flow of vital commercial and humanitarian goods like food, fuel, and medicine. The UN says millions of Yemenis are on the brink of famine. Meanwhile, Yemeni army backed by the Alaa fighters from the popular committees has liberated large parts of lands in Al-Jaf province in northern Yemen. The achievement came after heavy clashes with the Saudi-led coalition's forces over the past days. Abdel-Latif al-Washali has more in this report from the capital, Sana'a.
The Yemeni army says it has successfully liberated another 1,200 square kilometers in the northern Al-Jufa province after fierce clashes with the Saudi-led coalition's forces. The army, backed by the allied fighters from the popular committees, took control of the Al-Yatama area, the center of Khab and the Sha'ab district and the southern borders of Saudi Arabia.
Our armed forces, with God's help, succeeded in liberating the Al-Yatama area and its surroundings in the Al-Jaf governorate. They also inflicted a heavy blow on enemy forces in the large-scale military operation.
Experts say the liberated area is considered as the southern gate of the kingdom, and this will open new routes for the Yemeni army to launch further retaliatory operations deep inside Saudi Arabia.
Al-Yatama area is geographically important for us as it's a border area overlooking the Al-Khadra port. With its new operation, the Yemeni army has managed to cut a major supply artery in Saudi Arabia. Today, we are in full control of southern gate of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and we can launch further attack on Saudi territories.
Saudi Arabia has been intensifying its air strikes against residential areas across Yemen, killing more civilians, including children. This has pushed the Yemeni army to escalate its operations on the ground as well as inside Saudi territories.
Yemenis say they will always support their army until Saudi Arabia stops its war and siege imposed on their country. They believe that the military operations are the only way to force Riyadh to move towards a political solution that ends the years-long war on Yemen. Abdel-Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
The Syrian military says its air defenses have confronted an Israeli air raid on the port city of Latakia in the country's west. The Syrian army says the Israeli rockets were fired from the Mediterranean Sea. Fire has erupted in containers stored in the port. Residential buildings and shops, as well as a hospital, have been damaged in the attack. There were immediately no words on the possible casualties. Israel frequently pounds areas inside Syria in similar airstrikes. The attacks mainly target the Syrian military, as well as resistance fighters battling foreign-backed terrorists. Israel's Ministry of Military Affairs says it holds the bodies of 80% of Palestinians killed during operations against Israel. Palestinians say this is part of a larger measure to put further pressure on the resistance front. Mona Kandil reports from the occupied West Bank.
Israel is currently holding the bodies of at least 91 Palestinians who were killed over alleged operations in the occupied territories. The Israeli Ministry of Military Affairs said that 80% of the bodies of those Palestinians remained in Israel's hands. The ministry made the announcement in response to an inquiry by the Israel Hayom newspaper on the issue, saying it will not return the bodies to their families for burial. Palestinians and human rights organizations have slammed the Israeli policy and the current decision as immoral, calling Israel a terrorist entity which aims to add to the suffering of Palestinians.
We are talking of about 91 Palestinians whose bodies are held in Israel. Also, there are the bodies of 254 martyrs buried by Israel in secret graveyard. It's part of a measure to prevent their family, friends, and others to glorify their memory.
Experts say that Israel is also holding the bodies of Palestinians as bargaining chips for future negotiations with the resistance groups, mainly Hamas movement, that is holding two Israelis and the bodies of two soldiers, possibly in exchange for Palestinian prisoners.
This Israeli policy constitutes a flagrant violation of the international law, so an urgent international action is required. The issue of the martyrs must not be used as part of any swap deal. Israel is treating the bodies of our martyrs as hostages.
In 2019, when Israel's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett was in charge of the military affairs, took a decision that the bodies of all slain Palestinians to be withheld, regardless of the organization the victim was affiliated with, or the type of attack they carried out or tried to launch. At the end of the day, Tel Aviv claims the measure is meant to deter other Palestinians from carrying out operations against Israelis. Tel Aviv refuses to hand over the bodies of Palestinians killed for alleged attacks on Israelis and uses it as a punitive measure against their families. At the same time, Palestinians say the Israeli forces continue to deliberately kill people in the occupied territories for the same reason or on mere suspicions and hold their bodies captive. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The political rift and conflict-ridden Somalia is deepening, raising concerns of political violence. The Prime Minister has now ordered the country's security forces to take command directly from him after being suspended by the President.
I want to share with the Somali people that the steps taken by the former President Mohamed Abdullah Farmaajo were a deliberate attempt at a coup against the government, the constitution, and rules of the country. As the President seemingly decides to destroy government institutions, and with his constitutional mandate already having ended, I'm telling the Somali people that the federal government of Somalia, performing its constitutional duties, especially in this transitional period, is fully responsible for leading all the government institutions. I order all Somali national forces to work together under the commands of the office of the Prime Minister from today onwards.
Robla made the comments after the presidential office announced the suspension of his powers, citing corruption charges and the abuse of public property. The political feud between Premier Robla and President Farmaajo has generated months of tensions in the African country. Both figures accuse each other of holding up parliamentary elections, which have been postponed numerous times. President Farmaajo has also removed from office the commander of the Marine Forces. In April, pro-government and opposition fighters opened fire on each other in Mogadishu after the president extended his term without holding fresh elections. While a gunman goes on a shooting spree in the U.S. state of Colorado, killing four and wounding three others, the shooting happened in three different locations in and around Denver. The gunman then engaged in a firefight with police twice and injured an officer in the neighboring city of Lakewood. He killed his fourth victim in the city before police shot him dead. His motive is so far unknown. Gun violence is a chronic problem in the U.S., where deadly shootings have triggered widespread calls for tighter gun control laws over the past years. But to France, national election campaigning is once again coinciding with state-sponsored attacks on their Muslim community. Dozens of mosque closures are just the latest assault on religious freedom, which appear designed to win the votes of an ever-widening far-right electorate. Romain Mazari has more from Paris.
With France's presidential election just 4 months away, Europe's largest Muslim community is being scapegoated and targeted by government repression as badly as ever. Almost 100 mosques have recently been raided by the government, with at least two dozen shut down so far. Earlier this year, a so-called anti-separatist law was accused of basically legalizing Islamophobia, as it tried to ban the hijab for minors and force the closure of not just mosques, but highly respected Muslim NGOs, such as the Collective Against French Islamophobia. The latest assault on freedom of religion for French Muslims has been sharply criticized by foreign leaders and top NGOs.
France is a republic which claims to be very attached to the idea that the state must be neutral towards all religions. But the past year has seen an incredibly tough interference and meddling in the Muslim community. They're entering mosques and telling religious leaders to say this and to not say that. And this reflects the shift to the extreme right of President Emmanuel Macron's government.
The dominant theme of France's entire presidential election has shifted to the extreme right, as convicted racist Eric Zemmour has provided coronavirus-era France with almost nightly Islamophobic diatribes. Zemmour has rocketed to third place in the polls, giving Macron and other candidates license to blame Muslims for France's economic and political problems.
Zemmour resembles Donald Trump of the United States in that both thrive on outrage, but there are significant differences. Zemmour's entire career has been based around trying to be a part of the political scene and conversation, and he has benefited from support from major parts of the French establishment the entire time.
Il est invité dans tous les plateaux.
Zemmour is invited onto all the television news programs, even though he's a political pyromaniac who is trying to rehabilitate the era of Vichy France, when France collaborated with the German Nazis. He's very dangerous for all of France, and not just France's Muslims, because he's appealing to those who sympathize with the era of French colonial barbarism.
Ever since the Great Recession began, France's political and media elite have stigmatized Muslims to a degree which has gutted the nation's claim to be a global leader in freedom of religion, thought, and speech. The three most popular candidates in the presidential election all seem to be trying to outdo each other in Islamophobia, which has France's Muslims expecting the state-sponsored racism to be even worse over the next 4 months. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
And that does it for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's guidelines for political activities of armed forces and said that he strongly warned these forces against involvement in political activities and membership in any political party or group due to the fact that it would undermine armed forces and ultimately harm the power of the country and the system. This week, we are going to discuss the situation of cinema in the pre-Islamic revolution era and touch upon Imam Khomeini's guidelines on the issue. Stay tuned, please. Cinema is a very important domain in culture and art of every country. Cinema entered Iran during the rule of King Muzaffaruddin of Qajar dynasty in 1890s. This art was not welcomed by ulema and religious strata due to its corrupt nature and the fact that it spread the European lifestyle. During the rule of Reza Khan in early 20th century, cinema found its way to other a few cities in addition to the capital, Tehran. Upon the fall of Reza Khan and excessive dependence of his son, Mohammad Reza, to the West, especially the U.S., hundreds of American films were screened. In those days, the U.S. started training of Iranian artists and filmmakers. In 1940s, from among 400 films that were screened in Iran, nearly 300 were American. After the U.S. staged coup d'etat in August 1963, the Iranian cinematic climate turned toward more profiteering and box office. Hence, entertaining films little by little found their way into Iran's cinema. In 1950s and 60s, pornographic films were gradually screened in some of the Iranian cinemas, particularly in Tehran. This corrupt trend continued till the end of the regime's life in Iran in 1979. During this period, the Pahlavi regime made every effort to screen anti-religious and pornographic films in every city, even religious cities like Qom and Mashhad. One of the researchers of cinematic issues categorizes the films of the era of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi in four groups. The first group included the films which would clearly ridicule religion. The second group composed the films of which portrayed religious themes like the deluge and the story of Joseph and Zulaikha in a deviated form. The third group was the films which used religion for mundane desires. Finally, the fourth group included few films which contained religious scripts. The Shah regime did its best to mislead young generation so that they would not have the time and motive to even think of the corruption prevailing everywhere in the country. In 1970s, clashes between cinema and religion reached their climax as the cinema had turned into a window for showing the Western corrupt movies. The ulema, led by Imam Khomeini, were strongly opposed to cinema of the Pahlavi regime as it had turned into a tool in the hand of the regime to push forward the American goals in the country. The Imam once said, "If a cinema is ethical and scientific, who will prevent it? But when we see that our country, from its cinema to its school, is colonialist, it means that these have been brought for us from abroad. They are the gifts that have been brought from there to corrupt our young generation and everything. If a mosque becomes such, we will close it too. The noble prophet demolished the there are mosques. That we are opposed to cinema, it means we are opposed to such a cinema. Imam Khomeini writes in his testament, radio, TV, the press, cinemas, and theaters have been among effective tools of decadence and numbing of nations, especially the young generation. During the recent century, especially the second half, what big plots were designed with these tools for propagation against Islam and the serving clergy? And for promotion of the Western and Eastern colonialists. They were used for the markets of goods, particularly luxurious and decorative goods of every kind, from imitation in buildings and their decoration and luxury to imitation in drinks and clothing. If, God forbid, the servile and destructive Pahlavi regime had continued, every soon our dear youth would have been corrupt by various devilish conspiracies and schemes of the regime. Or they would have destroyed their youth period in the centers of corruption. Almighty God did a favor to us and them and rescued all from the mischief of the corrupt and the looters. Imam Khomeini, warning the statesman, writes elsewhere in his statement, have you forgotten the spread of indecency all over the country and in the centers of corruption, from the brothels to gambling houses, bars, cinemas, and other centers, each of which was a big factor for corrupting the young generation? Dear listeners, next time we will continue the discussion.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israel has announced doubling settlements in the occupied Golan Heights. This comes despite the fact that the move is deemed illegal by the international community. Why then would Israel decide on this, and why at this time? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the significance of such a move, the silence by the U.S., which some take as an approval of Israel's move, and whether this could spark a conflict between Israel and its enemies.
Israel captured Syria's Golan Heights in the closing stages of the regime's 1967 war on Arab nations and annexed the occupied territory in 1981 in a move that was not recognized by the international community. The UN Security Council, in its resolution 497, adopted unanimously in December 1981, declared the Israeli decision null and void and without international legal effect. Nonetheless, former U.S. President Donald Trump granted U.S. recognition to Israel's sovereignty over the Syrian territory in 2019. The administration of current President Joe Biden which remains critical of its predecessor for its unilateral approaches, has not taken any move to reverse the decision. Amid the U.S. blind support, the Israeli premier unveiled a plan on Sunday to double the regime's settler population in the occupied Golan Heights from the current 25,000 with a multi-million dollar plan. The land is rich in water sources. Naftali Bennett said the move has been prompted by the Trump administration's recognition of Israeli sovereignty over the Golan and the Biden administration's indication that it will not soon challenge that decision. Syria has reacted to Israel's decision to expand the number of Jewish settlers in the occupied Golan Heights, calling it a dangerous and unprecedented escalation and a war crime.
Israel continues with its settlement policy and systematic violations, which are war crimes. The Golan Heights is an integral part of Syrian soil, and we will work to return it in full to the homeland by any means permitted by international law.
In the light of the U.S. backing, Israel has also been expanding its settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, which are illegal under international law. Palestinians believe the U.S. brokered normalization deals between Israel and some Arab states have emboldened the regime to press ahead with its expansionist agenda and land grab policies. But such expansionist policies are just the tip of the iceberg, as acts of violence by Israeli forces and settlers have intensified against Palestinians in the West Bank. That alongside frequent shelling and air raids against the besieged Gaza Strip. The international community has stopped short of taking any practical action in the face of Israel's seizure of Syria's Golan Heights, the occupation of the West Bank, and atrocities against Palestinians as a whole. Israel's aggressive policies will not change the truth that the Golan remains part of Syria, but its fresh expansionist move will create further tensions in a region that has been paying the price of Tel Aviv's destabilization activities.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, we have journalist, activist, and political analyst John Busnish, who joins us from Belgrade. We also have journalist and author Daniel Lazar, who joins us from New York.
Is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, gentlemen, welcome to this edition of The Spotlight. Daniel Lazard, I will start with you. For people who are not familiar with the Golan or the Golan Heights, which have been referred to as the occupied Golan Heights, why don't you give us a history check as to where the controversy is here, or misunderstanding?
Well, Israel took control of the Golan Heights in the after the 1973 war and has moved decisively to Israelize them, to fill them with settlers and other kind of forms of development. And the world, while formally stating its disapproval, since the developments are in clear violation of international law, has done absolutely nothing to stop them. Now, Israel's strength in the region has only grown since then, and U.S. backing has grown ever more unqualified. So therefore, Israel now feels emboldened to double the population, its settler population in the Golan, and to further solidify its hold over the conquered region.
Well, let me ask you your reaction on this, if I may,
John Busnich, let me bring that up as to what Naftali Bennett has said. This is our moment. This is the moment of the Golan Heights when he announced and said Israel intends to double the number of illegal settlements in the occupied Golan Heights. What do you think that Israel has taken the decision to do this now, to make this announcement of this depth of settlements coming at the Golan Heights?
Well, considering that this is coming in the first year of U.S. President Biden's term of office, one can presume that every move that's being made by Israel has been previously approved and checked in Washington. So I guess that what we're seeing here is the payback for the investment that Israel makes in the U.S. elections. And just to let your audience know here, the United States government is called the best government that money can buy, and not for no reason. In the U.S. elections, the financing for the candidates for president in particular, because that's the executive office and deals with these kinds of international issues, the financing for the two candidates is very heavily skewed in favor of Jewish Americans and pro-Israeli, pro-Zionists. There are born-again Christians in the United States that consider the state of Israel essential to the United States. And so what we've got here is a quid pro quo. The government of the United States is largely selected by Israeli financiers because it's impossible to get elected in the United States without hundreds of millions of dollars. And once those office holders take office, they are required to pay back the people who paid for their election. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're seeing now. And that's why Mr. Bennett is referring to this as the special hour for the Golan Heights. It does not change the fact that the Golan Heights are a legal part of Syria, that the United Nations has declared this, and that is international law.
Well, I'm trying to understand, Daniel Lazar, what international law means when, as you mentioned, Tel Aviv unilaterally annexed the Golan Heights back in the year 1981. So here we are, it's the year 2021. Well, almost over now, it's going to be the year 2022. So whatever decades that is, what happened?
You're absolutely right. I mean the term international law covers a multitude of sins. And essentially, the bottom line seems to be that the U.S. and its allies have every power, every ability to do what they wish. And they call it legal because in today's world, might makes right. So you're right. This is contrary to international law, but the United States chooses to disregard international law whenever it wishes, and so therefore the phrase is becoming increasingly meaningless. So I totally agree. By the way, I wouldn't want to exaggerate the impact of Jewish voters in the United States. American Jews are less than 2% of the population at this point. What's happened is that across the board, across the entire foreign policy establishment in Washington, Israel is now determined to be of prime importance in terms of U.S. imperial interests. And virtually all factions agree on the importance of maintaining that U.S.-Israeli alliance.
Well, since you're saying that, and since you have also said that, John Busnich, again, I don't want to veer off the topic here, but we know that there has been somewhat of a development when it comes to AIPAC in terms of the way that they're going to, be part of the U.S. decision-making when it comes to, let's say, the midterms. From what I understand, this was a development that came just recently. So are we talking about more influence by Israeli lobby when it comes to decision-making, such as what we have noticed on the Golan Heights? What is the U.S. stance? We know what Trump catapulted this into recognition. Does Biden hold the same view, even though Bennett said he does?
Well, I take note of your other guest's comments. Mr. Lazar is right. Jewish voters in the United States are only 2 or maybe 3% of the voters. I'm not talking about votes here. I'm talking about money. John Mearsheimer produced a book called The Israel Lobby,
when I was working as a lobbyist in Washington. And what he turned up in the statistics for the donations to the two parties was that although Jewish Americans only make up 2 to 3% of the voters in the United States, the donations to the Democratic Party, 60% of the donations to the Democratic Party come from Jewish Americans, and 40% of the donations to the Republican Party come from Jewish Americans. So it's not the votes that we're counting here, it's the dollars that we're counting here. And that's why we can say that the U.S. government's policies are being skewed by exorbitant power of the Israel lobby. Now, to get back to the subject at hand, the idea that Israel can proceed by doubling the number of Israelis in the Golan Heights, the current population of the Golan Heights is roughly 50-50 Arab and Israeli. If the Israelis seek to double their population, that would give them two-thirds population in the Golan Heights, and they might attempt to make a referendum there and pass it by two-thirds sometime in the future. That policy is illegal. It does not change the fact. And I'm very sorry to make this parallel, but Adolf Hitler seized the Sudetenland from Czech Republic, from Czechoslovakia, right before World War II by stating that the majority there were ethnic Germans. That is a terrible precedent for Israel, a country founded as a result of the Holocaust, to follow. Uh-huh. That is what we're dealing with here. Mr. Bennett is following policies that resemble those followed by Adolf Hitler before World War II.
Okay. We're looking at a reaction, Daniel Lazar, coming from Syria, naturally. And what I'm looking at over here in terms of the reaction of the foreign ministry, condemning the plans to double the number of the settlers, the Golan, within 5 years as a dangerous and unprecedented escalation. So what is Syria thinking right now? It's seeing this happen. It's being bombed practically every other week. What is Israel's plans? Because we're looking at the military side, bombing of Syria, and now this. What are Israel's plans when it comes to the Syria in turn? Is this a natural progression we're looking at here?
Yeah, I think we are, actually. I think that's a good way of describing it. It's a natural progression. I mean, look, Israel has devoted itself to the destruction of the entire northern sphere of states, of Syria first and foremost, but also Iraq and Iran as well. I mean, I think the figures are that Israel has conducted more than 100 bombing sorties over Syria in recent years. It is determined to spread chaos in this country. It was a big supporter of the U.S.-Saudi war on Syria, which reduced that state to near rubble, visited incredible destruction on the Syrian people. One of the really great crimes of the 21st century. And that's continuing. So on one hand, Israel wages relentless war on Syria, and on the other, it seeks to strengthen its hand in the Golan Heights, which it took from Syria in 1973. So it's kind of like a two-pronged strategy: destroy mm-hmm. your enemy and strengthen your own base. And Syria, you know, Syria has had its hands full. I mean, it's fought a desperate action against the U.S.-Saudi-led campaign of destruction. It's managed to hold itself together, even though, you know, the eastern half of the country is still occupied by the U.S. And there's little Syria can do except to try to sustain itself under this withering punishment mm-hmm. Launched by both Israel and America. So, Syria, it's amazing that Syria has survived and sure. as well as it has, but that punishment is not going to go away soon.
Mm-hmm. John Busnich, I can't help but listening to Daniel Lazar explain what Israel is doing to just skim over something that is a violation of international law. The bombing of Syria, and when I said it's a natural progression as to the Israel moving towards Syria, that's just, you know, it's not a huge deal. But I'm guessing, and I'm almost sure that it is. And, you know, and we're looking here at my question to you, at a reaction that has to come. Are we looking at a spark here that will then entail a reaction? And my question to you is, from whom and how? Because at this point, Syria is being bombed. The Golan Heights is being having settlement construction happen there, probably sooner than later. What are we going to see coming?
Well, as you know, I've worked as a political advisor on three continents, and I'm sorry to have to admit that one of the standard policies of every kind of political activity is to make a step too far and see if you can hold it. And that is what is happening in this case. Israel is attempting to make a step into absolutely illegal action, an act of aggression, as you rightly mentioned and as your other guest underlined. It's an act of aggression. And the policy, it seems, on the part of Mr. Bennett as the Israeli leader is to see if he can get away with it. Now, if he gets away with it, that just gives the go-ahead for the next step. And the next step could take any number of forms. So now it's a question for whether the United Nations would take any action. That's number one. Of course, the United States would veto such a move. And then if the United States vetoes any action at the UN, then Syria would have to look to supportive powers who have protected it in these recent years. And that obviously points to Russia. And I think that Russia has an unsettled score with American occupation forces in eastern Syria, and we could see an escalation that brings in some form of confrontation between Russia and America on the ground. That's the short-term worst-case scenario. The slightly longer-term worst-case scenario is that Syria attempts some kind of military action against Israel, which I don't think Syria is foolish enough to do at this stage, having just suffered the destruction of so many years of bombing. So I think we're in a bit of a stalemate, but Israel's actions demonstrate one thing in particular, an unwillingness to negotiate and an unwillingness to seek peace. And when you have a side that's unwilling to negotiate and unwilling to seek peace, then you're actually activating non-standard confrontation. Mm-hmm. That means bombings, that means terrorism, that means whatever alternatives are available to the people who are the target of the aggression.
I'm curious, Daniel Azar, what Israel's partners, if I may call that, are thinking about this, the ones that, you know, signed that so-called normalization deals, like the UAE, or when you talk about Bahrain, that this is this what they thought Israel would do? Did they anticipate something like this happening in terms of Israeli action? And especially, of course, when it comes to things like Palestine, but in particular when it comes to Syria. I mean, we know that the UAE had his foreign minister just recently visit Syria.
Well, unfortunately, the truth is really dreadful. The power balance has never been more lopsided. The U.S. and Syria, U.S. and Israel have never had a freer hand in the Middle East. And states, you know, dictatorial states like the UAE have completely, you know, folded into the U.S. imperial presence. And a state like Bahrain, for example, is a dictatorship at war with its own people, a minority Sunni dictatorship, which is imposes terrorism on its own largely Shiite population. It's completely outrageous, and unfortunately the imbalance has only worsened over the years. So there's no answer in sight. I mean, all we know is that the U.S. weakness is exposed in Afghanistan. Its military leadership and political leadership are both incompetent. Israel is very strong, but it may be in the end less strong than it currently appears. And that the situation in the Middle East as a whole has become so unstable and so explosive that it can't continue much longer. But beyond that, we really can't say anything. For the moment, the balance of power grossly favors the U.S.-Israeli side, and that is likely to continue for the near term, at the very least.
All right, so quick answer from you, since this is the last question. John Bosnich, are we looking at these settlements actually going ahead? Are they going to get executed? Are there going to be Israelis actually living there in this area that's occupied? And what form of reaction are we going to see, if any? And I hate to say just reaction, because there should be action taken to prevent this from happening from the so-called international community.
Well, you're absolutely right. And each time that Israel declares an openly illegal act and proceeds to execute that act, it's one more brick knocked out of the so-called wall of international law. If that wall collapses completely, the only alternative is war. And I'd like to make the point here that there were crusader kingdoms in the Middle East that lasted longer than the state of Israel has lasted so far. And there's a good possibility that if Israel doesn't come to terms and come to some kind of peace with its neighbors and respect their legal borders, that the state of Israel will end up like the non-existent, long-gone crusader states.
Of course, that depends how much money they have to spend inside the U.S. when it comes to the politics there. All right, we'll have to leave it there. Thank you, John Bosnich. We appreciate it, journalist, activist, and political analyst. Thank you for your contribution. And also, Daniel Lazar, thank you, journalist and author there from New York. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikovit Tahweh, entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Well, hello and welcome. This is another session of Q&A on Islamic beliefs, and this is IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, and we have Dr. Karimi with us to continue the discussion of animal rights and the process of sacrifice, the ritual of sacrifice. Hello, Doctor. In the previous session, we talked about the ritual of sacrificing. We said that the animals have been created for the benefits of human beings. And we talked that this has a long history in other religions. Also, we have the ritual of sacrifice. And the number of the animals that are considered to be a good point, a good cases for sacrifice, are very limited. They're not in a large number that would affect the animals. Now, today we will have to talk about the animal rights. Shall you please talk about the animal rights for us?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. And thank you for that summary. The point is that some people who are arguing against slaughtering the animals in the religion of Islam, they claim that they are pro the rights of the animals, and Islam is not like that. But when we refer to the verses and the narrations and the viewpoints of the great Muslim scholars, especially we are talking about Shia scholars, we will see how Islam is highly respecting the animals. And you can claim that Islam is the best religion in terms of considering the rights of the animals. There are many points to be mentioned in this regard. The first point is the fact that according to Islamic jurisprudence, especially Shia jurisprudence, animal in and of itself is a respected being and creature of God. So, for example, one of the famous Shia jurists, Sheikh Muhammad Hassan Najafi, who is the author of the well-known Jawahir al-Kalam, he says that animals, they are, I mean, respected beings, and it is an obligation upon the people to quench the thirst of the animals. And it is absolutely forbidden to torture the animals keeping them thirsty and not quenching their thirst. Not only that, بل هي واجبة النفقة علي. You know that we have the concept of nafaqa in the religion of Islam.
Yes.
For example, the sustenance should be provided by a husband and father for his family members. Now here, these Shia scholars talk about this nafaqa as a kind of the nafaqa of animal to be a kind of obligation upon the owner.
Yes.
So this is the way Islam looks at the rights of the animals. And not only that, according to some narrations, there are rights for animals upon the owners, including quenching the thirst, feeding the animal even before himself. And then he refers to a very great point. He says that the fact that Islam asks the people to respect the animals is not because of the fact that animal is a property. It makes a great difference how we look at this obligation. Yes, we need to, quench the thirst of the animal. But what is the reason? Is the reason that it is a property of us and we should keep it alive? Or no, it has another reason. He says that no, it's not only because of the fact that it is a property, it is your wealth. Rather, it is because of the fact that it is a living being and creature, and because of that, it has all these rights.
Rights, yes.
Sheikh At-Tusi, the great Shia scholar, also, after referring to the fact that the nafaqa, the sustenance of the animals, is an obligation upon the owner, he says that لَأَنَّ لَهَا حُرْمَةً, it, the animal, has a great respect. The same has been mentioned by Allama Hilli. Now, we said that according, as you rightly mentioned at the beginning, when we're talking about the slaughtering the animals, Islam only permits that for a few number of the animals, not all of them. But to begin with, according to the religion of Islam, all the animals have the right of life, and no human being has permission to kill the animals without any reason.
Yeah.
So even when it comes to sheep, camels that we are allowed to slaughter, we cannot just kill them for fun. It should be based on a kind of wisdom. Otherwise, it is absolutely forbidden for you to kill and slaughter the animals. So I would like to share some narrations which tell us that you are not allowed to kill the animals.
Yes.
For no reason. Some of the narrations, they do not refer to any specific animal. They just mention that without a justified reason, you have no right to kill the animals. For example, the Holy Prophet is quoted as saying, or rather it has been mentioned that إِنَّهُ نَهَى عَنْ قَتْلِ كُلِّ ذِي رُوحٍ إِلَّا أَيُّذِي. You have no right to kill any creature that is that has a kind of soul. And you know that according to us, according to the religion of Islam, animals also have a kind of soul.
Yes.
Unless they are bothering you or, dangerous to you. In that case, yes, it is based on a kind of wisdom. But, beside that, we have no right to kill the animal. It is absolutely forbidden.
So one reason is for protection.
Pardon?
To protect yourself.
Exactly. Yeah, only in that case we are allowed to do that.